Rochelle Rochelle.
Ugh.
I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Yeah.
We should go see Rochelle Rochelle. I hear it's really hot.
No, thanks. Maybe some other time.
Really? Do you really mean that?
Rochelle Rochelle. Now playing at the Paradise 2.
My name is Rochelle. I'm from Milan. I'm supposed to visit my relatives in Minsk.
Did you see Rochelle Rochelle?
Oh, thanks.
Come on, we can still catch most of Rochelle Rochelle.
Rochelle Rochelle, huh?
A young girl's strange, erratic journey from Milan to Minsk.
McGee, we got a little silver screen second where we're going to take a brief second to quiz one another on some Tinseltown trivia and test our Hollywood insight. And I got a question for you, and it's multiple choice. You ready, McGee?
I wasn't, but now I am.
All right, McGee, the commentary on this film is really, really interesting, and we're going to sing the praises of the physical media Criterion edition of this film a little later. But one of the anecdotes that was shared on here from Jennifer Tilly, she tells of an incredible story about Gene Borkan, who plays Roy the bodyguard in this movie. He's the one that shoots at Joey Pants in slow motion. So he shoots the mob boss first, and then we see the other bullet come, and then he's like rounding the corner and he goes to shoot him. So that's Gene Borkan. And he's also the last body thrown.
Spoilers.
Oh, you're right, host. The spoilers for this film is going to be a little bit of a shootout. A B character you may have never heard or seen about is shot at. But he's also on top of the pile of bodies in the shower. Like he's like the last body on top of the bodies that you see, right? Don't worry about it. This is a movie from '96. You guys will catch up quick. He's also notable for being the greed victim in Seven, who's like the one that's hunched over and he has like the pound of flesh removed from his side. Now, what Jennifer Tilly says that he's really proud of that he did on both sets, where he successfully negotiated more money on both productions for A, on the Bound production for having water poured on him, and he was previously unaware that that was going to happen. So, again, he's the body in the shower that Caesar turns the water on, didn't know that was going to happen on the day, and was successfully able to negotiate more money from the production. But he also did this on the set of Seven, because in that scene, that greed scene, he didn't know he was going to be in his underwear. So him and his were successfully able to negotiate some more money. What I want to ask you, McGee, how much money was he able to wrangle from the Seven production? Jennifer Tilly actually has the number. She says it in the commentary. Was it A, $200? Was it B, $4,000? Was it C, $75? Or was it D, $8,000.
Those are all way too low, dude.
Well, that's your choices, McGee. You got four of them. Was Fincher cheap? What do you think? Like, how much was he? He was previously unaware that he was going to be he's going to be in his underwear in the scene. Wrestled some more money on this film again. He's in the shower scene. He's the last. He's a top body in the shower. Gets water poured on him.
What are my options again?
A, $200. B, $4,000. C, $75. Or D, $8,000. What do you think? How cheap was Fincher on the set of Seven? $4,000 too much.
Fuck.
$75 too low. $200 too right in the middle there. Or $8,000 just right.
I don't think he would brag about $200 though. That would be, if you're looking at Jennifer Tilly and you're telling her, hell yeah, I got myself $200. It's like, no, dude, come on. I really hope, I'm just going with, I hope it's D. I hope my man got $8,000.
D, $8,000. Unfortunately, McGee, he's a little bit of the chud that you think he is. It was A, $200.
Oh, no.
He negotiated.
That's hilarious.
$200.
I kind of respect it.
An extra $2 from that scene, McGee.
I'll be honest, I respect him more that it's $200 than it's $4,000. Because $4,000 seems like he's genuinely bragging. 200 seems like it's a bit. 200 is it seems like it's a wink and an elbow nudge and a hey, check this out. And like, I bet I could get a little cash, I can get a little walking around money out of this guy right here.
Well, 200 is about what they had in the budget for this film in 1996. Bound, coming up after this. All right, welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, who's bound to have a good time with this one.
Oh, my God.
Sean McGee, how you doing, brother?
Oh, fucking hell. I wasn't ready for how terrible that pun was. God damn.
This is a show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You'd be doing anything else with your time. We are so happy you're here with us. Follow our socials in the show notes while scrolling down there. Please rate, review, give us 5 stars, and support your local artists. We also want to mention, too, got some cool zines, some cool stuff that we're doing over at the Patreon. If you guys want to be a part of that monthly zine kind of Patreon outreach thing that we do, please hit us up in the Patreon. Let us know. Let Nat know that you kind of want to get there. She includes a zine that's full of, you know, her picks, all her music recommendations, a whole bunch of fun stuff. And there's also like little stickers and stuff that you'll get along with that. Love this, particularly this month in Sexploitation. We got a little 8mm strip of I'm not even sure what film it's from, but it's a little Sexploitation film. Really cool.
It's from Uncle Ann's private stash is where it's from.
Hell yeah. Actually, maybe that's not a bad name for the for the thing we were talking about.
Oh shit, that's a really good name for the Patreon segment. Fuck! Yeah, go sign up for the Patreon and we'll send you a little clip. Not literally this clip that is from February, but I think the name of the zine going out is going to be Uncle Ann's Private Stash. That rules. We'll have to run that by Natalie, or maybe she'll find out when she listens to this episode.
And I'm going to toss it to McGee. What do you think people should be pairing with this movie this week?
I think that what you should be pairing with this movie is subscribing to our socials, because come interact with us on social media. We also have some fun stuff coming up. We'll be a little bit more active on there, promise, and it'll be a good time. But yeah, there's some real cool stuff going on there, as well as the Patreon. So make sure you go check us out.
Yeah, please. Down there in the show notes, you can find our social links and join us there. And on today's episode, we have my pick for the week for Sexploitation Month. It's in 1996's Bound. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling, and then dive into this film with our world-famous segments that bring down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes stories. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 96's Bound.
For me, stealing's always been a lot like sex. Two people who want the same thing, they get in a room, they start to plan. It's kind of like flirting.
You're having second thoughts.
I'm just making a point. I want to see the money.
It's over $2 million.
Welcome to the family. You're amongst good people here.
I have a tattoo. Would you like to see it?
These people are serious.
Johnny! He's making too much noise!
Here.
Put it in his mouth!
Caesar is gonna get the money. He's gonna bring it by the apartment. He's gonna count it.
Where is it now?
It's in a case on his desk. It's perfect.
All right, that was from the trailer of 1996's Bound. Logline here: a tough ex-con Corky and her lover Violet concoct a scheme to steal millions of stashed mob money and pin the blame on Violet's crooked boyfriend Caesar. Crooked is a little rude. Crooked seems a little unnecessary in that logline.
IMDb, what's going on? What's going on, guys? You don't
IMDb,
like the mob?
What's up?
What's up?
Do my man Caesar justice. Joey Pants for president. This is written, directed by the Wachowskis, shot by Bill Pope. fucking legends all around. Starring Gina Gershon as Corky, Jennifer Tilly as Violet, Christopher Maloney as Johnny Marzone, and Joey Pantaleone. Mm-hmm. Is it Pantaleono?
Pantaleono or I always say Joey Pants. So Joey Pantaleano.
It's Joey Pants.
Yeah.
As Caesar. But this movie was absolutely a blast to watch. Spoiler for my reaction.
Hell yeah.
But I am curious to find out, E, why'd you make us watch this?
Well, you know, I had a few films in contention. And all of them were like, had a little bit of this, but not enough of this. Like a lot of them were a lot hornier, but a lot less structured. And then, you know, this one I felt like had that balance where it's a fun rewatch. I thought, because it's been a few years or something, so I'll be honest with you, so I thought it was a lot hornier. I thought there was a lot more sex in it, to be honest with you. So I kind of felt like this is a bit of a tame choice for sexploitation, and I didn't really know how you're going to react to that. I was like, oh, maybe this film isn't horny enough for what we were trying to do here.
Yeah.
But it was fun to dip back in. What?
I'm just laughing at you worrying that this film wasn't horny enough. It's such a funny dynamic. I don't know if that says more about you or me.
But it is a little tamed in how it's in the amount of sex in the film. I think I should say it's a very horny film, but there's a lot less sex than I remembered in the film, if that makes any sense. So, but I do think it's a fun rewatch. I think this is a really fun noir, and I think it's the origins of two of easily the most consequential filmmakers of the 90s, early odds, and they would go on to revolutionize and define action filmmaking. And there's like this before and after moment in the history of cinema, I feel like, and the Wachowskis sit very squarely in the center of that. And to kind of look back on their origins, I think Bound is so sleek and confident and structured, and it like takes advantage of every gift that it's given. Whether or not it's a benefit to the overall outcome, I'll save a little bit of my critiques coming up. I think, say, in the case of the Italian production design for Caesar's apartment, like the wall of maps that are behind him, excellent, beautiful, love that. But maybe in case of like the tidy whities that Gina Gershon puts on a
little
mic.
It's the 90s, baby.
Just using all of what was available and the people who are committed to capturing it and making a really, really fucking fun debut. I think the cast here, even in small roles, is solid across the board. I think both Tilly and Gershon play a very convincing couple, in my opinion. Like, I buy them sticking together through thick or thin in this. And I think, obviously, that's one of the challenges that the film presents is this couple going to hang tight through this caper? You know, like, can they trust each other?
Yeah.
You know, so on and so forth. I also think this is a lost gem. Similar to the theory that I put forth in the Get Out episode all those many years ago. And if you guys should join us for the best of Make Me Watch, it's a really fun journey to kind of take that first year and how early we were. But in that episode, I said, you know, The Matrix is such a huge film and Get Out was such a huge film that you wouldn't be mistaken for thinking it was their first. And many overnight success stories have like a 10-year prelude. And one of the most interesting things I think about this is the team they pulled together for this production will go on to carry on into their next defining effort or genre defining effort. And I strongly believe to my core that the success of The Matrix is due in large part because they established those early collaborators here and they already had the secondhand language of like working together, and so you don't need to necessarily think about that on the next production and like add that challenge. You can just really start to innovate and work out a lot of the kinks on this film. And again, while we're going to praise this, you know, tooth and nail, I think there are some elements that I did find a little less successful, elements that seem forced in the mafia that I want to kind of get into, Gino's hat that I'm going to get into here a little bit. Maybe don't feel as authentic as I've seen done in other, you know, in other worlds. Granted, this is a very heightened world, and there's a particular elements that are heightened, but I don't think that they're starting from a place of intimacy. They feel like they're starting from a place of exaggeration. So they kind of come off as a bit of a caricature. But what this film ultimately gets right,
I can't believe you're being more critical of this movie than I'm just like going to be like, yeah, whatever.
But what they ultimately get right is the dynamic between these characters and the radicalizing of queer sex on screen. And I think the many choices and lengths they go to sort of value a lesbian relationship in this film. I think the structure of this is so unbreakable, and like how it's linked together, that's what kind of keeps me coming back, is like how smoothly they transitioned into establishing these two women, establishing the caper, going like, so the telling of the plan and then sweeping us back and forth in these time fracturing kind of ways. So Corky's telling part, or Violet's telling part of the story that Corky's intersecting in, and we're just moving and flowing. And I think that kind of confidence for just like two unknowns on their first project is here, yeah, to unfold. Like it's insane. It's insane how talented these siblings were right from the fucking start. It's,
yeah,
insane. So love this film. Can't wait to break it down. Let me toss it to McGee and see what you thought on your first viewing.
Yeah. I can't believe I haven't watched this movie before. I absolutely had a blast watching this. If this is one of those movies where, like, just to start with, like, anyone who has any doubt that trans women are women, this is the most, like, for lesbians by lesbians movie I've ever seen in my fucking life. Like, yep. This is, they shoot the shit out of these women, and they like you said, the to see this, like, queer representation on screen is done so smoothly and so well. It's so stylish and tasteful and 90s as fuck, which is not a three combination of three elements that, like, go together very often. Like, it is just dripping with personality. It's so, to see so many of the calling cards that they do end up, like you said, changing the game with the Matrix. Mm. But to see how close of similarities there are, just like aesthetically, stylistically, just
the sound,
like
you said, design.
The sound design, the sound design in this movie is so fucking good. Like, just the attention to Foley, for somebody to come out of the gate and have the attention to detail that the Foley work is so fucking good, that just like every element top to bottom, every character gets a little moment where they have some sort of insightful moment where you, the actor's getting to do something to establish with the character, mm-hmm, who they are on a deeper level outside, mm-hmm, of the script. Like, I feel like there's so many little elements of that.
Absolutely.
Where, like, you mentioned this movie being cast perfectly, but it's directed so fucking, like, impeccably, where it felt like the cast gets highlighted and gets an opportunity to shine in all of these little moments, even with these, like, really small roles, as much as, like, they're afforded to, because this is a pretty limited cast. Like, obviously they're working on a budget here.
$200.
You never see, like, you see the budget if you're aware of how hard it is to make something stretch. Mm. And, like, you start to become aware of, like, how few sets they really have to use and how condensed
fucking gold with what they got.
They spin fucking gold out of this, because I don't think anyone who isn't familiar with the movie making process, like, intimately, would really be cognizant of how little money this movie had. Mm. Like, it just looks great. So yeah, I had a blast, like, top to bottom with this movie.
Hell yeah. And we also, if you haven't seen this movie, or you're looking to explore some more contents around this movie, I can't suggest more of the Criterion Edition. There's a 4K Blu-ray that was just recently released, I think a couple years ago. I could be wrong about that. I can't remember when I got it. But this is my first time popping it, because I'd seen it, I'd owned it, but I hadn't owned the Criterion that came out. But this is my first time popping it open and getting a chance to see some of the special features that's included along with this. Some great interviews, obviously, with the main cast. But there's a modern noir section in here where we're talking to Bill Pope and Don Davis, who does the music for both this film, and he'll carry on with The Matrix, and some other fun characters, the editor, and I want to say Susie Bright is involved in one of these, and she's the consultant, the sexual consultant on this film, and the queer consultant on this film, to kind of get things that I'll talk about a little later on in the spoilers that I wasn't necessarily aware of that I've noticed before, now that I'm noticing now on these more recent watches. So it's really fun stuff with her. A great all-around collections of supplemental materials that I think is absolutely necessary. And the commentary of this film is so goddamn good, because I didn't realize how funny Joey Pants is in just like real life, just like talking and just like the one-liners that he gets off and the commentary is great. Jennifer Tilly and Gina, they were late to the commentary, so they like pull up with a third of the movie left, and you just got to hear them rush in the room, and they like start apologizing. So, like how they carry on the rest of the commentary, where like Jennifer just basically takes it all over because she's, you know, she's an actor, so she's doing her old thing and pointing out all these things. But it's really fun. That's where that anecdote, you know, up top came from. It's just like, so she's just throwing out there with the last third of the commentary. So really great stuff. Would highly suggest it. Want to toss it to McGee before we get out of here. What blue? If somebody else loves this Blu-ray, who would it be? Who do you got? Who do you think?
I had Rose Glass, who directed Love Lies Bleeding. Okay, did you watch Love Lies Bleeding?
No, I didn't. I didn't. But that's another
Be Gay Do Crime movie, okay, for sure. Very much like queer neo noir.
Right.
I think a pretty easy. I just Googled it to see if I could find her talking about this movie at all. I didn't see any headlines or anything. But it's a pretty, I think, obvious inspiration for that movie. If you haven't seen Love Lies Bleeding, it's a really fun watch. I think it's maybe I'll put that one on for sure.
You know who I went with? I think I actually may have brought him up before, but it has been a while since I have. I went Guy Ritchie. Early Guy Ritchie has this same sort of and what I really want to praise moving forward with the Wachowskis is their use of transitions, like where they know how we're going to get from one scene to the other in the smoothest way possible. And I think Guy Ritchie is clearly a filmmaker that thinks about his transitions, and we're not doing a star wipe to get in out of these scenes. They're actually
on a screenplay level too, where it's the dialogues echoing across scenes as a transition, where they're like just really building on the visual language as well, like just fucking some pro shit, like right out the gate.
Little tease for Peep the Script coming up after this.
All right, welcome back from the break. We're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot from here on out. We will be spoiling the film, starting out with the big bang. Does that opening sizzle or fizzle? And I'll start us out here because this is one of my few criticisms of the movie. I have two very light criticisms, this being one of them.
Is it the title sequence?
I don't think this movie needs the like 90s Tarantino chop up of like non-linear action, with the exception of like the heist stuff where they're talking about the plan. But the cuts to her tied up in the closet, one, a little on the nose for a queer film. Two, I think entirely unnecessary, because the opening, like, sexually charged tension of this movie is so strong that I don't think you need this closet scene at all. I think that you could just open with that elevator, them eye-fucking each other, and that's enough of a sizzle. This Tarantino wannabe, like, I think everyone was too hot. It feels like a producer note. Mm-mm.
They thought about this from the start.
That's honestly, like, I just didn't love it because I didn't think that the movie needed it at all. I felt like the opening sexuality between our two leads is so well put together, and it ramps into the heist of it all very smoothly, that I just didn't need the kind of preview of the tension in order to have stakes.
I mean, here's the thing. I hear you. I also, you know, noirs, a flash forward is a staple of a noir. You know what I mean? Like Sunset Boulevard, we open with with Man in the Pool, where Detour woven in with him walking.
It's done Ansef, wrong like... more than it's done right, though. Even if it's a staple, I feel like it's used poorly more often than it's used well.
I don't.
Maybe I just don't like that trope. Maybe that's just me.
I hear, because it's a little like the Sonic jumping up in the screen, like,
I've done it in the edit.
You're wondering how I got here. So yeah. Like, it's a little bit of that, but I don't mind it for a couple
record scratch.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I don't mind it for one, it's a staple of noir, so I appreciate it on that level. And they're referencing a lot of old noir in this film, obviously. Two, in the script, and this is going to be our first little peep the script.
Straight West Coast style. Peep the script.
Well, I'm going to take you into a choice that they ended up. Let me hit you with this. Let me present you with this, because I love that you've already stated your case. I hate it. Let me see if I could change your mind.
I like your real quick summation of my case is I hate it.
Let me see if I can change
your
mind.
You heard all of that spiel and you took out I hate it.
No, I think I'm going to feel so awkward in this conversation trying to touch on the queer elements of this film just because I don't want to say anything like, you know, overly offensive or ignorant. Forgive me, I was raised on Dre and Snoop, so I'm doing my best here. So I don't want to say that the element of her being in the closet is stagnated or old trope or old hat. It kind of, it works for, at least
I'll
it works for
it.
An idiot for me. Yeah, that's something. Maybe for the idiots in the audience.
For
like
the 90s,
me.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like maybe it's a little more radicalized for the 90s. So I don't mind it. I think it was kind of, I was like, all right, let's see what we're doing here. But that's just one. And then the flash forward is another. But let me present you what was in the script that I think may help to salvage this a bit. Because what I love how we start is Caesar is over Gina Gershon's character. And the sentiment of the first line is he's saying is not trusting people like her. Like he realizes at this point of the film that she's a lesbian woman. So he's I can't remember what the line is, but something about not trusting you people, blah, 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 blah. So he's kind of putting her in the closet. Now we go from that scene and we sort of echo that line in the next scene where she's talking. And this is the scene that ended up getting cut. And the film was bookended by these parole officer visits. So she has her first parole officer like flashback after this scene to where the parole officer says the same thing, but he's talking in a sense of her criminality. So he goes, something, something, not trusting you people, because you're a criminal. And I think in the script, the echoing of that sentiment from two different perspectives, not trusting you because you're queer, not trusting you because you're a criminal, I kind of like that bit. Like,
here, I love that.
You know what I mean?
I like that a lot.
Like how that would have, because I think if there's one thing moving forward with this film, I think her early thing of her being a criminal, I wanted to kind of step on a little bit more. Or like she has, if there's a kleptomania thing or she's just a really highly skilled thief, I think I wanted that. And I think I'm missing a little bit that. And that parole officer meeting sort of cemented that this is somebody that's like teetering, you know. And we get, I'm not saying we don't get a little bit of that. Caesar asked her, how long have you been in jail? And this
no,
and the third,
I have,
but yeah.
I have one. So
Pete the script thing, you would have kept it. You would have included it. You would have put it.
Oh, I absolutely would have included it. I love that. Should I spoil my studio notes? Because studio notes is kind of riffing off of that.
Oh yeah.
But that was the scene that I would have added, which I think works really well with the parole officer bookending, is that there's a middle part where Corky doesn't have a lot to do. Mm-hmm. Which understandably, when like Joey Pants is losing his shit, then he shoots everybody and they're dealing with the bodies and everything. Mm-hmm. There's just like a middle
kind
chunk
of passive for like 20 minutes. It seems
she's just listening through the wall for like a good chunk of like an hour into the movie. And then it picks back up or whatever. So I felt like there were two opportunities to maybe bring her into the plot a little bit more where I think that she could have gotten rid of the cops or at least like stalled the cops in some way. And you could give Joey Pants the moment of like, is she involved? And then him be like, no, like she's just being cool because I gave her money. Mm-hmm. Like she's a criminal too. Mm-hmm. She's looking out. She's on my side. Like this is just a stroke of luck of the draw. Right. And then you can have a little bit more of that. Like when he figures everything out, then he's like, I'm putting all the pieces together. Blah, 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 blah. And it just gives her something to do in the middle of it. But then the other thing I think, there should be a fake out where one of them thinks the other one took off with the money explicitly.
I disagree. And there's something that's
But I think that plays off the criminality aspect of it, like you're saying, and the like, I think it plays up that tension of are they really true to each other? Or are they setting each other up? And they do tiny little moments of that I think for the version that's put out there works perfectly, where like when you don't have those additional elements, like the scene that you're talking about and the scenes that I'm talking about, like I think just having her have those little moments of doubt and then immediately kind of push it down and say like, no, I'm you know, like I think there's a version of this movie where you can kind of draw out those elements where each of them has an opportunity to make out with the money and betray the other one. And we see them both actively decide not to. So we give Violet a chance where
I like that if we mirror that not instinct, or if we mirror that sort of feeling from both characters.
At some point, Violet should have full possession of the money and the opportunity to fully run, but she would be abandoning Corky, and so she decides not to. And then we should flip it and have the same thing with Corky. I think Corky should happen first, just thematically. But
the only reason I kind of reactively said I don't like the idea, in the commentary, there's a professor from some Santa Cruz film school, whatever. I forget. I apologize. I don't have her name in front of me. And also Susie Bright, who I said was a consultant on this film. They mention as far as how the relationship is handled and giving this queer relationship a stronger sense of, like, they aren't the untrustworthy lesbian character that's like, you know, it didn't undermine their bond to suggest that they would have run out on each other. They both mentioned that in two separate interviews is kind of like, is being lesbians appreciating that aspect of the relationship, of the, it was always treated as a fucking like an unbreakable bond, and they weren't duplicitous in that way that you've seen other queer characters handled in the past. And so I had a little
realistic drama where they were like kind of snipping at each other, but that was like very early,
not knowing, like, you know,
feeling each other out a little bit.
Like, I'm a sex worker, this is sex, or this is work to me, you know what I mean?
That's like, right. I think that you could kind of pay off on that idea later by like showing that their bond has been reinforced at this point, like they really are in it. But I agree that, like, that's why I said, like, the version of the movie as presented, I don't think needed it. Mm-hmm. I would have liked those additional scenes that you brought up in the script. And I think the things that I was thinking of kind of play off of that. But ultimately, I totally agree with, like, the statement that you brought up there.
And it also ends, like I said, with another parole scene. So after, you know, she gets the, she kisses, I can't remember, it's not Gino. Gino gets shot, I think. She kisses one of the dude. Hey, do you need a favor? I'm going to just go ahead and take off. I need to get out of here.
Corky, the other guy that shows up.
Corky goes and sees her parole officer for whatever that last time, and essentially, they have sort of that rough, gruff, like, oh, you're never trust you people. Or so, Larry, get out of here. I never want to see your face again. So you don't worry, you never will, or something along those lines. And they leave. So there was a nice, I think it felt like a more well-rounded, fuller bookend with the pro officer. I'm a little, I wish we would have kept those sequences. So I just want to bring that up as far as the script. Yeah. Want to move on here to scene we show someone to get them to watch. What do you think, McGee? What scene in here was, tell you what scene I think some people should get them to watch.
I mean, I think I always try to make this the scene that I pick kind of this like summation of the themes of the movie also, like to really like to dial in on what the movie's about, as to also get someone to watch. Where so I think this one, the stealing is a lot like sex monologue that she has in the truck.
That's a good
one. I think has the like The two of them in the truck, obviously there's a scene with the two of them in the truck. It's probably more what you're thinking.
No, the seduction in the living room with or the pipe, like beginning there. That's just a straight up.
Yeah, 100%. But the one that I picked with the little monologue there, I think is highlighting the crime elements and the like lead up to the heist, but like has such of that, like everything she's saying is dripping with seduction. Where it's like these two women just want to fucking jump each other every time they are just making intense eye contact, and it's just oops all eye contact. Like it's just I think it marries the elements of the sexploitation theme that we're going for very well, which is why I thought it was so funny that you were so doubtful of yourself, where I was like, oh, the fucking opening 30 minutes of of this movie are so aggressively horny. It rules.
I did good, did I?
Yeah, you did good. You did good.
Let's see here. I obviously, you know, so I went with the seduction because I think there's, I think it's almost a little even heightened more than like just like the porn version of it. Like the guy comes, the contractor comes over, the plumber comes over. Like it's even a more heightened version of that. We're obviously going to get into some shots a little later, not shot for shot.
Yeah.
But it's the funny, it's in the way filmmakers shoot things, and particularly filmmakers coming from a different, like the Wachowskis have all this contracting and fucking Chicago Painting Labor Association, whatever behind in their background. So like all of the, like the hyper specific like stuff in the script about what nut she's actually turning and how she's turning it. And like her, like the use of just like what her background is, so fucking funny to see that in the film and like instilling that in there, with, you know, the, anyway, it's funny to see those elements. Like I like seeing a little bit of like Wachowski in that seduction scene.
It's so heightened and so natural at the same time. Like somehow it's more porny and less porny simultaneously.
What do you mean?
Like they feel like very real people. Like this feels like just they're dialing it up, obviously, but it feels like real people dialing it up, like trying to do that dance where they both really know what's going on, but they're just waiting for that dam to burst, especially in like queer, like I wasn't gay in the 90s, so I don't have this experience, but like the extra heightened sexual charge of it being taboo because it's so scary to actually admit is not a thing. Like I you know, like it's not an experience that I really had to deal with, you know, in the modern age or whatever, but like absolutely it's a thing of like, it's like the scary parts and the sexy parts of our brain, those wires get crossed easily. So like how scary it is to be publicly gay in the 90s and this, how vulnerable you need to be to seek out gay sex in a world where people will do hate crimes, like your rights are less than the, you know, you have, you're a subclass of citizen because you're not allowed to be who you want to be. And so the vulnerability that it takes to actually cross that threshold turns into edging, where you're both like, you're both like, approaching it as close as you can, but like you're kind of scared to take that final leap, and so you're letting the other person get even closer, and so they're doing the same, and it just, you're just edging each other closer and closer. So it, yeah, that's part of it, that's part of what's hot about it, like for sure. But like, so they just capture that so well in this scene, that that's what I mean, where it's like
the seduction,
this is the most like seduction scene that you picked for your scene to show, like that's part of where I was talking about in my opening, where it's like this is the most like by lesbians for lesbians shit. Like I say that as a man, obviously, but like from my perspective, it was like they captured that element of queer sexuality very well.
Let's talk about the sex itself, since we're in Sexploitation Month, and this film is clearly that's the, anyway, the sex, the sex. I didn't even know where I was trying to go with it.
I got the straight boy all flustered.
No, I do appreciate a lot.
I'm just fucking with you.
I do want to say the straight sex, or this is something that I had caught this film that I had noticed before, listening to the commentary and just picking up on these little subtle details. One, the straight sex in this film is all behind walls, like not on screen at all, and it's only the queer sex that's what's celebrated on screen. It's just something that it really didn't even dawn on me, because I was like, I know that Caesar.
They knew they were like, this is going on the gay film circuit. Like, we do not want to show.
Oh, interesting.
PNV. Right, yeah, right. That's their target. That's their market for this movie.
No. I understand that, but we wouldn't include it because that would turn that audience off, or that would.
Absolutely. Hey, it's nobody wants to see that in the fucking gay film festival as like a straight sex scene. Absolutely not.
Okay. So I the Wachowskis have a certain way of shooting sex that I feel like it kind of crosses over. If you take this scene, you take their other scene in Matrix Reloaded, where it's just the white writhing bodies in a very artful fashion kind of like shot. It's not the very... It feels a little more technical and clinical than something hotter than, say, like your typical French 3-hour, you know, art, quote-unquote art film. That sex film in the 90s, you know what I mean? Where it's... I'm very curious about your take on the style of how they're shooting this. The elongated rounding out camera moving walls as we're seeing that. Is that works for this film, I guess? What am I trying? I don't even know what I'm asking you.
I feel like that scene, you know, needed to be in there for sure. But the scenes that I think about when I think about the sex in this movie are... Like the scene of them in the truck where she's like,
right.
I'm apologizing. And like, I hate when women apologize for wanting sex. So that's not what I'm apologizing for, is such a good fucking scene. Yeah. Like, oh, that hits so good. Like that's so hot, so much hotter than anything else that happens in the movie. Is just her just being like, no, that's not what I'm apologizing for, is so fucking like, that's better than the sex and than any of the scenes that they shot. That line rules, hits so hard. But yeah, so like I feel like it is the like, I like the over stylized swooping camera in the sex scene. Because we get all of the other versions of it, like the like close ups of breathing and the like the how sexy like the like glimmer of a touch can be, where they're like afraid to even make contact. Yeah,
I'm so glad
like,
you said that. Can I mention one thing that I put on top of that? The other thing I had noticed in this film is, or at least listening to the commentary and Susie speak on this, is the hands being a primary sexual organ for lesbian couples, and just the way that they were shot and framed in this film is just something I didn't necessarily pick up on. And the way that, after hearing that, I was like, oh, wow.
That's where I'm like, this is such a lesbian movie. Like, this is like, with the they have such a great eye for women that it's like, this is a... Yeah, trans women or women. And if you have any doubt from a cinematography perspective, this is a movie that will show you the evidence for sure.
Can we move on to Compliment Sandwich? Because maybe I'm going to bring it down a notch. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah. No, you're good.
So I love the Wachowskis. This is our Compliment Sandwich. I'm going to give you the bread right now, what I love. I love what the Wachowskis bring everything to this. And I think this is a collaborative art. You want to take everything that you can get. But I think some of the path of maturing as a director is knowing when to say no is like as pleasantly as possible, or at least to the point to where, you know, you're still kind of like instilling confidence in the person to swing again and like, let's just keep going with the ideas. Maybe that one didn't work. Because I wish they would have kept, like, I hate the quirky tidy whitey scene. I don't know, idiot. Like, I don't understand. I don't even understand.
Yeah, it looks bad, but it's the 90s.
It's not the script at all. I know this, just hearing the commentary, I know this is something Gina was brought to the set that day. Like, I want my character to wear this, and I think she'll be playing whatever this twang thing is.
That was the thing I didn't understand. Was like, why and what is that fucking noisemaker? Like, it's like,
I
want a tumbleweed to go through. It doesn't make any sense, because it's like, you already established that the walls are paper thin, so why are you like giving a auditory cue that you're sitting there listening to the murders happening? Right. Like, it just, I hate it. I hate it. That's also it. Yeah.
And the Gino's hat. So this is
that's such a I love that we move from what I assumed was the nitpickiest nitpick, which is the little noisemaker instrument, and then you're like, no, this one hat sucks.
I hate it. It's I know his last name. He's the director of The Vanishing Point. Like, he's actually a director. He did a ton of films in the 70s, The Vanishing Point being one of those.
The guy who plays Gino, Richard Serafian.
Yes, I was gonna say, is it
Serafian?
Something he walked on set with that he's like, it ended up in the film. Don't like it. I mean, these are some of the mafia elements as a whole, their emphasis on calling it the business, the wardrobe.
The business. Just, a big just, business.
A big mafia business. I just, all of that, I'm like, it doesn't feel convincing. It feels like exaggerations not coming from a place of intimacy. And I just, I'm not buying it. The whole mafia thing, for whatever kind of sense, or when you see, I don't know. You see, David Chase, just somebody that has more of a stronghold on what these people were like, their dress, their talk, how some of these things would go. I feel like some of the mafia elements were really, really lacking on this one, which is a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
But so many of the other additions were, because so many favors were brought in for this film. Like I said, some of the production design elements in Caesar's apartment, all of the wardrobe, with the exception of the red velvet dress and leather jacket, was Jennifer Tilly's. Gina's obviously bringing a whole hell of a lot of things. I do want to make a comment about her coming up in our Under the Lights, as far as like an actress pick, casting note. Want to maybe see if I can dig my toe into that. But yeah, that's my compliment sandwich. A lot of value add here, but a couple things where I'm just like, oh, I wish you guys would have had. Because you could tell there's not a fucking like hair out of place in the Matrix, where that feels like manicured to a T. Like,
yeah,
you guys saying what's on script or sticking to the shot list, and this has come out exactly the way I fucking wanted. Here, it felt like they were a bit more malleable, to where like let me try.
Oh
this.
Yeah, I mean, when, like, you're trying to make every dollar stretch, yeah. Like there's a lot of things where it's like, you'll bring that, sure, we'll make it fucking work,
right? They were in that making work kind of stage.
I will say in the defense of that note, I will say, like, it's the 90s, so fashion's awful for the most part, and this movie makes them look good in every opportunity that it can.
I love the women. Wait, were you saying the mafia?
No, the tidy whities and the mafia hat, like, obviously, like, I kind of just internalized the actual organized crime is trying to emulate the movies. So their taste is also going to be like, they're drugged out emulating late 80s movies.
But
like,
but
their taste
still
isn't impeccable.
Like Martin Scorsese, like, I was raised with these guys, so I know how they like their ties. I know what how the cut of their suits are. It's like that.
Yeah, but that's East Coast shit. That's like not Chicago. Like, Chicago's a different fucking town. Like,
you're absolutely right. But there's so many different ways that, like, Chris Maloney's suits to me scream like a little try hard, and like I'm trying to be flamboyant in that way, but it feels like we're still kind of strapped into the little bit of the antiquated view of what the mafia would be like at that time, that I'm wrestling with.
It is a snake that eats its own tail, where mafia guys are trying to emulate mafia movies, especially in modern, like, especially 80s, 90s, like, we're not trying to do, like, traditional Italian shit. We're trying to look like tough guys because we're doing a bunch of drugs. So, like, I get what you're saying, that it would feel more authentic in the, like, Scorsese sense of the word, that was, like, the more lived in. Obviously, the lived-in versions of this went elsewhere in the, like, you know, queer aspects of it, where it's like, I don't know how much mob ties the Wachowskis had. Maybe I'm wrong, but who knows?
Didn't seem like many.
I think I can assume, but I don't think that it was so far off that it bothered me, but I don't blame you for that being something that, because I know that is something that, like, you know, you pay more particular attention to, where I'm like, whatever, fuck all them.
let me talk to you about something I didn't understand about the film. You got anything for this? Something you didn't, something you couldn't put together?
Just the weird noisemaker. That was all I had that I didn't understand. So what do you got?
I got the producer of this film, old Dino De Laurentiis. You know Dino, McGee, actually. The pod knows Dino. He produced a little film called Knights of Cabiria. A mambo!
Okay.
If you remember, a lot of fucking Fellini
films. One of our vaults, our unreleased vaulted episodes.
Yeah. Did like the 76 King Kong, Dune, the Lynch Dune, the La Strada, mentioned Fellini.
Yeah.
I get the feeling listening to people talk about him, Jennifer Tilly, how the Wachowskis speak about him in the background, some of the stuff I'm looking up, that he's a bit of an odd duck here. And he would do some things that were like, he could kind of see the diamond in the rough, but he wouldn't do anything to sort of dig it out or cause some pressure to kind of create that stone. He would just kind of like I think he has some talent. I see something here, but I get bored and I move on. For example, he produced the first Manhunter film for Michael Mann. And when he had the opportunity to do Silence of the Lambs, he passed on it. And then that makes, you know, googlobs of money in awards. So then he like hurries up and grabs like Hannibal and Hannibal Rising. And obviously that didn't make the splash that Silence of the Lambs did. So he has the Wachowskis to, and he can't see it. He knows there's maybe something there. They got a script. They got, you know, the two talented, you know, filmmakers, but he doesn't trust it enough. So he doesn't greenlight the script when they bring it to him, and when they shop it around and they start getting several offers right away, then he's like, well, you know, I'm going to see you guys if I don't get to produce this. And then, you know, they allow him to produce this, but here's the odd choice. Like in this film, the clipper scene, and we got to talk about this item, the totem of the film, these clippers, these clippers that he uses to cut off fingers, right? It becomes an important totem within the film. He fights tooth and nail to have this scene is muted and as null as possible, because he doesn't want to see the finger cut off. He doesn't want to see, and the script, it actually falls in the toilet, which I think is actually an awesome transition to, because it cuts back into the next toilet, or it flushes, and it, you know, whatever it's in. There was a better transition built for that scene, but they ended up in this one. The finger just kind of bounces along. He fights so tooth and nail that I think some international versions of this script of the film got it cut out. And Jennifer Tilly mentions one of those in England that she went to see, that, you know, that scene's not there anymore. So that when they're threatened with the clippers a little later on, you know, with Caesar in the bedroom, that it has a lot less potency because you haven't seen, you know, the violence that was committed with them earlier. You don't have that sense memory of when you see it. So it seems to be such a natural, obviously you got to see the person as a threat and use this is, you know, for making this item significant. But I couldn't really figure out what was going on with Dino in his "I like you, but I don't trust you" kind of attitude back and forth with the Wachowskis. Wonder if you have a take on that, on the Clippers specifically, as being a using that device at one, show the finger being cut off, have it look that violent as it was on screen. Was it necessary? What do you think?
I mean, I totally agree with you that I think with Jennifer Tilly, that the violence in the seeing it early makes the threat of violence more dramatic later. So it's absolutely thematically necessary. It's crazy to hear that. The note that I have, just like having the Wikipedia from Bound page open, the only like mention of Dino on it is that other executives were trying to get the Wachowskis to change Corky into a man. And that Dino just gave him, was like, Dino gave him the green light to do free reign with the story. Mm-hmm. So it's very funny that he was like, yeah, do all that lesbian shit that you want, but no fucking finger stuff. it makes it feel
fingers in this.
Oh no, get that! I don't want to see no fucking chopping fingers. Get that shit out of there. Are you the ladies fingering each other? Just fine. The men chopping fingers off? I don't want to see it.
The lights coming up after this. All right, welcome back from break. We're going under the lights, breaking down performances. We got to talk about the Trinity here: Gina Gershon, Jennifer Tilly, Joey Pants, the three-headed monster in this film. I want to start with Joey on this one. Entirely unsympathetic. Does Joey not have a little bit of a case to be like, hold on, wait?
He's so great. I love the performance. That's what I meant, like from a screenplay level and from the directing standpoint, like Wachowski's just nailed the shit out of this so hard, because Joey Pants is so gray. Like the natural cadence of a heist film, especially, is we make a plan, the plan doesn't go exactly according to plan, we have to pivot. And that's the dramatic tension of like the middle of the movie. So Joey Pants as Caesar just plays us so perfectly where he is more smart and more sympathetic than the girls give him credit for. And that's the complication for the second half of the movie is like they expect him to run and just panic. And the fact that he like sits and thinks it through and it like kind of does half falls for what they're saying, where he does it like think that Chris Maloney's character is the one that did it and is out to get him or whatever, but is smart enough to be like, okay, no, Violet, like, let's sit and think this out. Like, help me out with this. Like, I love that him, like, him being like, don't touch me right now. I'm freaking the fuck out. I'm overstimulated. I need to think this through. Like, he doesn't, like, put hands on her. He's not, like, freaking, he really plays it as, like, a, oh, no, like, he's kind of like, you know, he definitely crosses the line when he's like threatening fingers and shit, because obviously he's still a fucking mobbed up bad guy. But like he really does play it, and the script sets him up very well that he doesn't have to just be cartoonish villain. He can take these kind of roller coaster ups and downs of emotion where you're riding it out with him. And a lot of the tension of the movie is riding on him either playing the fool and then wising up just when the girls are about to get away with it, and then giving you the satisfaction of falling for it again. And like he's doing this dance that is so key to this movie, where I was crazy impressed not only with his performance but with like the direction and the screenplay and everything. Like just really came together in the weirdly complex character of Caesar.
He was told to study Humphrey Bogart in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which is definitely a film I want to put on for you, because I've mentioned it when we talked about PTA a little earlier this year or last year One Battle After Another. Is a film, and There Will Be Blood is a film that he would watch every day to sort of just take whatever he could get out of that film. But in that, Humphrey Bogart sort of slowly like drips into madness and gets more paranoia it's an amazing, amazing, John Huston, amazing fucking film. And
what was the name of it one more time?
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think I watched that one.
Oh my God. I've said a stupid thing in the past where I was like, endings that I had never seen an ending like The Killing before, where the money just flying all. Oh my, you guys, spoilers for The Killing, where the bag of money just flying all in the airport.
Yeah,
clearly I didn't think about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre having the ultimate example of this. So we'll be putting that on at some point in time. But Joey is playing it a lot like that, and that was his reference point, the Wachowski's reference point for Joey, particularly in the scene where he's, you know, he opens up the case and the boar head, you know, he's like we have that that rig that's to his chest, and he's like kind of walking the wall into the boar head. Great fucking stuff by Joey. Loved in this. He's told repeatedly from old Dino that he wasn't a leading man, that he was a character actor. And so Dino fought tooth and nail in this film to try to get Joey out, because he just didn't believe in his star power. Dino was right sometimes, and he would be wrong on other
Dino's
times.
All over the place. Shit.
But awesome performance by that. I mean, Jennifer Tilly. God damn. It's just, ooh, that's, oh, I wanted to bring up, what's my girl's name? Gloria Graham. There we go. Right off the top of my head. Gloria Graham is one of my favorite film fatales in like the early film golden era period of Hollywood. Jennifer Tilly is the successor of Gloria Graham, where she has the voice, the look, the confidence, the stature. I love everything Jennifer Tilly is doing in this one. Also gave the Wachowskis hell behind the scenes because she didn't want to be cast as quirky, or as Violet, she wanted to go as quirky and was trying to convince them throughout the production. She almost didn't sign. She almost didn't sign off on the film unless she could play quirky. But I'm like, you're clearly Violet. Like you were born to play Violet.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Why this is the struggle. So I
oh,
love those.
No, I'm fixing this bathtub.
Like, no, I don't. No, what are you?
Gina Gershon, here's what I want to throw this at you. Love what it, I love the tenacity. I love the commitment. Gina has, this is gonna be a lot more sleazy. This is come out a lot more sleazy than I mean it to, but Gina has like a perfect mouth in a way that like photogenically, I would
you
just
got
want,
a
like,
good mouth on you.
But I don't mean that in like, what am I trying to like? In the
she's
way
pouty.
That,
she
that,
does. She does a lot of pouty like looks in this movie,
it's literally the contour of her lips and like how it's like in a Peter Weller sort of like he was cast as RoboCop because that half of his face just looks dynamic in that mask, like the way his lips, yeah. That chin kind of cuts. With Gina, you could almost see, if I were to put like the Batman cowl on you, this looks cinematic enough. To, like this looks emotive. Mm-hmm. Like I just like this third of your face is incredible. But I do feel like a bit
that's
too
so funny.
Femme to come off as the butch version of the character she's playing. Thoughts?
I mean, I think she pretty fucking nails it. Like I think you could go more like butch with it, I guess, but like I don't know, I never at any point was I like, oh man, this girl's like, I mean, there's definitely points
why
where
the professor,
like when she's like
suit,
covered
like,
in
I
grease,
I knew I couldn't be the only one. I knew I couldn't be the
who said? Wait, who'd you say?
The film professor that's in the commentary brings it up too. I was like, I knew I couldn't be the only one. Like, I was like, her really? But maybe that's why I'll back off. If that works, it works. I guess, but for me, it always she read a little. She could have been Violet as well. That's all I'm saying. She felt like there
who was a, who's that girl that looks like her?
Gina Gershon.
Hold on. Yeah, she looks like 90s Gina Gershon. She played like Batgirl, but then she didn't or something. Ruby Rose. That's who I'm thinking of.
Oh, from the new Batgirl movie. Or the canceled back was that it?
It's not the Batwoman TV show. It's the Batwoman TV show. It's not the canceled Batwoman movie. The canceled Batwoman movie was someone else, but Ruby Rose was on the CW Batwoman.
You think she looks like Gina Gershon?
She's got the same kind of mask femme balance where I think the jaw, like you were mentioning, it's who popped in my head when you were talking about RoboCop,
right.
with just from like the nose down. I was like, oh, because I was like, oh, I could totally see Gina Gershon, especially like 90s Gina Gershon, as like a like old school Batgirl or Batwoman, and then I was like, oh yeah, Ruby Rose did that, and I was like, oh, they kind of do look a little similar. So yeah, I see what you're saying for sure.
Okay. I think if we were to do Time Machine, I could definitely see Ruby Rose reprising the role of, I like that. So yeah, let's move on to Best Line Read, McGee. I have one. It's actually not in the film. It's coming from the commentary.
What?
Like, I gotta tell you, it was funny as fuck. When I heard it, I laughed, right?
So okay,
in the movie,
hit me.
Where they do the scene where he's like, you know, I'm gonna ask you 10 times, Shelly, 10 times. And he puts the pierce or the clippers to Shelly's finger. Chris Maloney in the commentary says, they cut it. The Wachowskis ended up cutting. He said, but the line that he had that he threw out there was, make it 20 and cut off his toes, which I think, which I just love for that character. Like,
yeah,
I feel like
that's really good for that character.
Yeah, like
that's what I mean. Everybody knows their character so well in this movie that they get those little moments. I love when Joey Pants hands him the towel and he starts patting his face and he's like, put it in his fucking mouth. That's such a, so funny and so perfect for both of their characters. The line that I had was Joey Pants, obviously, is when he walks in on them on the couch in the scene you were talking about earlier. And he's just like, what the fuck is... And he's like, oh, I thought, fucking Doc in here.
What the fuck Corky, this is Caesar. Caesar Corky.
I thought... fucking dark in here.
It's fucking dark in here is so funny,
so
man.
Good.
It's so the way he plays it, the way the edit plays it, like every part of it comes together so well. It's such a fucking funny moment.
Joey has,
but I feel like everybody gets those little
him.
Moments.
But,
yeah,
but you know what?
Fucking Dino.
Yeah,
Dino, full of
way
shit.
Fucking off, dude. But he reprises this role. Kind of in Sopranos, like he has a big villain arc in the Sopranos, and
yeah,
literally
yeah.
this character essentially. So he does get some shine. Like you do see Joey gets his shine later on in roles very similar to this.
You know, another line that I didn't love the delivery on, but this pen was so good that I'm definitely putting that in my pocket for when I get an opportunity. Is when Corky goes up to the bar and is like, "How you doing, Sue?" She's like, "Like shit." And then there's the beat, and she goes, "Well, now that we're all caught up." I'm putting that one in my pocket. Yeah. That's a line that I'm gonna fucking use.
Hell yeah. Good shit. All in the script,
like shit.
Yeah.
Well,
now that we're caught up.
It's so good. Such a good line.
Let's move on to best fit. Nancy Malone, costume designer. You can also see this segment in our show notes. Click down there in the Patreon
Holy
page.
Holy shit.
Go
we
ahead and
did
check
it.
Out.
We yeah. did it, folks.
Hell yeah. I obviously went with Jennifer Tilly. I love her in the lace negligee spaghetti strap. This is just like her look. She is the embodiment of that Betty Boo kind of femme fatale version of this character. Like someone that's like, when you reach a casting that is that perfect, just oh my god. Oh my god. Wish she would have been in 18 more films with the Chowskis.
It's funny that her you said most of her costume was like from her personal closet, right? You said a lot of the stuff that she brought.
Yeah.
I mean, she nailed it for sure.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they also shoot the shit out of her, as we'll get into in the shot for shot. But yeah, they really nail the costumes and the looks here.
Yeah, let's get into it and Behind the Lens coming up after this.
All right, we're going Behind the Lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and curtain close. You can follow this segment as always. There's a link in the show notes to our Patreon. It's a free post. You don't need to sign up to see it, but you should sign up while you're there. But yeah, go and follow along with the shots there. The first shot that I have is from about 11 minutes into the film. It's the scene we were talking about earlier. It's the outfit that we were talking about just a moment ago. It's the beginning of the like plumbing porno setup with Jennifer Tilly and Gina here. The shot in particular that I picked is, you know, when she's like under the sink fixing the pipes, and you have this close up of her face kind of reacting to feeling how close Jennifer Tilly is getting. And what I love, the outfit that she's wearing isn't particularly scandalous, but they shoot it so hot that it feels like it is. Like when you go to the wide, it doesn't feel like this is like a particularly horny dress, but in this shot, the way that they make the hem of the dress go just below the cutoff where the little window where you can see your legs, so you just get the little hint of skirt and then oops all legs, and then you just like Gina is just kind of like feeding off the aura of that sexuality. It's just shot so fucking horny that it elevates every element of it, and that this is part of that eye that I've been referencing, where it's just like they've just such an eye for women loving women that this scene feels so authentically horny that it's just such a great watch.
Great shot. Love that too. Like it was a little element so that rises a little bit above other directors.
yeah.
Move on to my next one. Mine's gonna be a little bit out of order, but I think I wanted to bring this one up first. Because it's I think when I first looked into this film, it was for, you know, obviously the Wachowski's origin, because I was told this is the origin of Bullet Time. And I feel like you can kind of see it here. You can kind of see the spark. So we started the sequence, and I should say this is the Joey shootout. It takes place at about an hour and 3 minutes into the film. We start with a series of extreme close-ups, and it's of Gino reaching for the gun, and then we get a close-up on Caesar's face, or his eyes, extreme close-up on his eyes, sort of closing, and the audience may believe he's kind of quietly resigning here, but then we get another close-up of Safarin. If I mispronounced that, I apologize, but he's like sort of smiling and further leading us down that primrose path, and that boom, that squid kind of goes off on his chest, and we got this amazing springboard rig to where it like just sends him kind of floating backwards until he lands, and it's so smooth. Like, I think they just that for that rig to have happened with a man of that size, yeah, that age, like land as smooth as he does. I love that technique too. And then we get the Joey is stunned, and then in this moment he's so focused on the person he just shot that he's not thinking about anybody else in the room, and his concentration is broke when you see the bullet sort of
seeing
fly
the
past
bullet
himself,
hit the like, glass looks so good.
That may be, I strongly think, origin of Bullet Time. Like, seeing how slow that bullet went, crashing into that mirror, like, that feels where they kind of get that idea to, like, slow bullets down and use them in an artistic way to, anyway, love this.
It's funny because you lost me and then you won me, because the shot of him falling back, I think, was one of the only times that I was a little jarred by the cinematography, mm-hmm, where I didn't love the mixture of time ramping.
Okay.
Where I felt like I knew how fast he was falling, but that's not how fast the movie was telling me to think that he was falling.
Run that back one more time. You knew how fast he was falling based on what you were seeing or what you were feeling?
Yeah, there's like little visual cues of like him, you know, being an older gentleman, mm-hmm, him trying to keep himself steady. So you see little like micro movements.
I see what you're saying.
But the acceleration of him slowly falling and letting down doesn't match
the
speed of everything else that you're seeing in the scene. So like it took me out of it for that moment, mm-hmm, where I didn't like that shot at all. But I 100% agree that the shot of Joey Pants looking down just zoned the fuck out, mm-hmm, and that's where I love the shot of him closing his eyes before he pulls the trigger, where you know it's him resigning to like, well, this is going the other way then, I guess.
Yeah.
Like like I had a plan and now I got a different plan, I guess. Like the closing of his eyes and the resigning to his fate as he pulls the trigger and fucking kills the mob boss rules 100%. The shot of him falling back kind of jarred me a little bit, and then immediately brought me back with the Bullet Time shot that you're talking about, where like you see the bullet traveling through and hitting the glass, and that little moment of recognition is so effective at making you feel how disassociated Caesar is in the scene, where it really is that moment is so elongated and so stretched out. And like we've talked before about like different traumatic moments in our life that like you feel that time dilation in real time, where you're like, oh, this isn't I thought this was just a movie thing. Like, no, this is actually, my brain is doing this in real time. Right. Wow. But that was such a realistic and like effective way to portray that feeling, even if it's, you know, like heightened or whatever. So like, 100%, like as much as the other shot took me out, that shot brought me back immediately.
Love that. What you got for us next, Biggie? Because I love your next shot as well.
Yeah, my next shot is from about 38 minutes in. There's a gorgeous, really, really like showing your hand, not afraid of making your camera work obvious. The kind of like bumping up against what I was just talking about, or the other shot that took me out. Like, this is one that shows the excellence of knowing when to be really showy and when to be really dramatic. But the iconic imagery of starting on that like dollar bill and doing the like the pivot spin, the Killmonger spin.
The turn. Let me just, because they bring this anecdote up in the commentary. They actually tell Jennifer Tilly, because the cut or the shot right before that is Jennifer Tilly's face that's supposed to sort of match the Ben Franklin face on the bill. So her direction that they gave her was look more like Ben Franklin. And so that was the shot. And so then it transitions into Ben Franklin, and then we do the turn.
Not enough old pervert. I think you need to have more of an air. You need to have a more
perversity in your face.
Yeah, a resigned elderly pervert in your face that we're really missing from the expression here. But no, I love the way that, this really showy pullback from the face into all of the depth of field of all of the bills hanging everywhere like Christmas lights, like, mm-hmm. And then just it's such a like made for the trailer shot, but in a way that it worked for the pacing for me in the mm-hmm. middle of the movie, where we're moving from planning the heist into the actual implementation of like, oh fuck, shit's going down, like the plan's in action now, right. And so having this really kind of showy, almost designed for inclusion in the trailer, which I didn't watch the trailer, but I can't imagine that they didn't use this shot. But yeah, that was just shot,
like in the trailer, in the marketing, there's a couple covers that have like,
yeah, no, with this, money. Yeah. It feels like that was the idea here. But in the edit, it does not feel out of place. And I think that's my favorite part of the combination, where they really nail the two.
I love that. I'm going to move quickly through my next two. In fact, the next one, it taking place at an hour, 18 minutes. Very quick. It's a sort of a wilting violet.
Yeah, he got me.
Where the strong geometric like hard light source and like her rigid posture just walking into the scene where she's like, she's almost like hunched in this stand, like where her arms are almost stilted like Frankenstein. She's just hunched over this phone, not wanting, or I guess assessing her next move, or I have to call Corky. I just pray Corky's on the other side of this line. I love the fall off of the highlight, or the fall off that like highlights the back of her jacket a little bit, like softly, but those highlights that I just like back here, that stance, I just love this as a noir pose. And then her profile hunch into this is just, for whatever reason, this shot, this little 11 seconds, I'm just really in love with this as a noir, neo-noir-ish touch. They have the little aesthetic bits in here that just sort of really is just my neo-noir fan. Gets me going.
I almost bought you this lamp, I think, actually.
Is that right? It's that hard ball of light.
Yeah, I was looking at like weird lamps to get you because I was sick of looking at your featureless wall behind you in the video feed here, and I think this was one of them on the list.
You would have been you'd have my aesthetic palette, because I definitely love this one. Next one, I'll move forward to. What is my next shot? Oh yeah, got to talk about this one. So this it comes a little earlier. It's about 37 minutes into the film. I kind of set it aside, or at least the last one, because it's almost like you kind of need the dialogue a bit to help sell what I'm trying to say here. But I love their use of transition, particularly in this moment, of Vi telling this story. We're in the past tense. We're in the the flashback. And then Gina Gershon just sort of wraps around her shoulder and then like from the present, and then says her lines as if she was sitting on the bed next to her. And we sort of flash out of the sequence. So cool, so stylish in their use of that fluidity of bouncing back and forth in the story, and in this one, so creative to have her kind of show up in that, in the in that sort of,
we could have easily called out Soderbergh for Ocean's 11 Blu-ray on the shelf,
because it's
like, it feels like this style of fluidity is now associated with Soderbergh because of Ocean's 11.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a great example of a version of that is then hearkening back to the other greats that Soderbergh was absolutely referencing here. But absolutely. Yeah, I 100% agree. I love this transition.
Love that. And that was actually my where everything kind of comes together to me is in their use of that. There's another one, a great one, like when they're in the car in the scene that you love, like where, you know, the really hot scene of them saying, you know, I'm apologizing for what I didn't do. And we sort of boom up from that into the bedroom. But we start at her boots. And so when we boom up into the bedroom, the boots are like in the foreground of
yeah,
that shot
it's
there.
So
too. It's just like
good.
A connective
That's,
tissue. Yeah. Just like, the, yeah. like all the transitions
it's
they
so
thought of.
It's fucking smooth. Dude. Yeah. This movie's fucking yeah. like silk,
oh,
man.
There's another one I meant to. I'm just thinking about this down this scene. So when Caesar's making the drinks, when Chris Maloney, the one that he punches in the nose,
a TNT.
Yeah, exactly. In that line, where he says it's like two TNTs, and he's at the bar, and then we sort of pan over, or we don't pan. We slide over into like that that brick sort of glass fixture on the table, and there's like 1,000 Caesars in each one of those bricks, like just
I
kind
love,
of like
that's
looking.
One of my runners up for shot for shot. I have a screenshot of that in my downloads that I didn't send you, but I have that exact same shot. I know exactly like what that, shot you're fucking talking
like,
about.
Oh, gorgeous. Just ideas like that, you're like, fuck, dude, they made like we said, they made gold out of the little budget that they had for this film, because those are some really fucking cool ideas. Press play on this again.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I had a blast with this movie. I can't believe I haven't watched it already. I wouldn't ever be mad at watching it again. Like, this was a really great sexploitation pick. It wasn't what I expected you to pick. Like, I didn't pick. I was expecting not so gay for sure. But but I really appreciated it. It was fantastic. Yeah. No, it was a great one to put on.
Hell yeah. Yeah, one I hadn't seen in a while, but very fun, noir, sleek, early Wachowskis, two of my favorite filmmakers, two filmmakers that made a huge impression on
no,
me.
No, I get it. Yeah, I get why you picked it for sure, but it was just not what I was expecting, and I loved it, though. It was excellent. No, I'm excited for the upcoming pick. You excited to see what you're watching next?
I'm a little nervous. I'm not going to lie to you.
Like, we'll be nice to you. We'll be nice to you. Don't worry. Find out after the break.
Coming this February to video stores everywhere.
Next week, we have a very special guest near and dear to the podcast. It's our the head of our Patreon fan club, Uncle Ann's private. What was it?
Private stash, right?
Is it private? Oh, yeah. Uncle Ann's private stash. Natalie is coming on the podcast again. Bringing us beyond the Valley of the Dolls. This is the 1970 satirical musical melodrama written by none other than Roger Ebert and Russ Meyer. This is a screenplay by Roger Ebert, directed by Russ Meyer. We're doing a guess the log line here. I sent E the poster. What do you think the plot of this movie is?
So I'm embarrassed. Because obviously, Ebert means a lot to me in terms of his career. And I know that this is his film. I have not yet seen it. So I am fucking clueless on Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. I'm going to say it's a musical, correct? You said you mentioned it was sort of a musical. I want to say it's a take on like a Stepford Wives kind of thing. Like maybe there's a new girl to a community or a neighborhood. And then she realizes something's kind of amiss, something's wrong. And then somehow or another, all of these women are somehow being manipulated or controlled by some force that they then sort of battle back against in the last third of the film. So the... For what I'm thinking dolls. I don't know.
Close to yeah, I mean, it was a noble effort, but it was a pretty solid D minus. I don't know, maybe C minus if I'm being real generous. This is the log line from IMDb is as follows: An all-girl rock band moves to Hollywood in hopes of achieving success, only to be lured by an eccentric music producer and his entourage into a whirlpool of wickedness and decadence. This is available for rent or purchase from the usual suspects. It is also available on the Internet Archive. If you just Google Beyond the Valley of the Dolls on archive.org, it will pop up for a public access version if you're on a budget. So it is for free.
Hell yeah. Looking forward to this. Nat coming on the podcast next week. Continuing Sexploitation Month. Some good stuff going on. Let's keep it going.
Hell yeah. Looking forward to next week.
Next week. Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Playbox, theme song by Soul Spy. Coming soon, folks.